I am Gautam Kumra, Chairman of McKinsey Asia, and you are listening to the Future of Asia podcast series. The Asian century has begun. The region is now the world's largest economy. As Asia's economies evolve further, the region has the potential to fuel and shape the next normal. In each episode, we are going to feature conversations with leaders from across the region to discuss what Asia's rise means for businesses across the globe. Join us.
Hi, I'm Lola Wetzel, a senior partner and director of the McKinsey Global Institute based in Shanghai. Very pleased to usher in 2024 with our Future of Asia podcast with one very important repeat guest and one very important new one, though both are old friends. We have with us Robin Harding, from the Asia editor of the Financial Times. Based in Hong Kong, Robin is responsible for the FT's reporting from Australia to Afghanistan, and was previously the Tokyo Bureau Chief, as well as the U.S. Economics Editor. Joining us for the first time on the podcast is Clay Chandler, Executive Editor of Asia for Fortune. He's based also in Hong Kong, oversees Fortune's editorial operations throughout the region, including the Chinese language edition, and regularly contributes features, commentary, and news analysis to the both English language magazine and Fortune.com. So, welcome, Clay, Robin, to the podcast. Good to see you again.
Hi, Lola. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. I'm honored to be here.
Well, 2023, it's in the rear view mirror, as we often do. Just let's take a quick look back and see how we did. What were some of the big stories that happened in 2023? How did they compare to some of the things that we thought might have happened? I can say for myself, I'm not that good at look back analysis, but this is the one time of the year where we do it. So I'll just start with that open-ended question from your side. Or what were some of the things that really struck you about 2023? Robin, maybe we start with you.
Yes. So I didn't go back and listen to what I said last year. So I have no idea whether it was completely stupid or very insightful. I'm just going to assume that it was very insightful. I think that there were obviously some geopolitical surprises in 2023. I don't think that anyone anticipated the horrible events in Israel and Gaza, and things like that are the bread and butter of the news business and just inherently not very predictable. On the economic side, I look a lot at China. I think that the consensus in general was disappointed by how slow and encumbered China's economic recovery was. I think that globally in 2023, we saw inflation come down pretty meaningfully across the developed world. I think that was largely anticipated, but certainly I think this time last year, there was a fair bit of debate about how high rates were going to have to go and how much inflation would come down. And I think that's largely been resolved in favor of a reasonably soft landing for inflation.
Yeah, I think you're off course. It's really fair on the geopolitical side. There were some events that we talked about, but nothing about the Middle East, really. Clay, what about you? What stood out for you?
I would sort of raise almost the same things. I had a glance, actually, at your transcript from last year, and it was very insightful, I can assure you. I think one of the things that you pointed out, Robin, was that the word that no one had in their crystal ball 2 years ago would have been Ukraine. And then, just as you put it, this year, the word that was missing from all of our crystal balls was Gaza. And maybe getting into 2024, you could probably add what's going on in the Red Sea to that. All those things, you know, none of them directly related, but they do have a kind of similar dynamic to them in that they have had a tendency to disrupt global supply chains and slightly push up prices in a way that people didn't anticipate or bargain for and remain fairly unresolved. And I think the inflation, the two things that didn't happen, the kind of sharp resurgence of the Chinese economy, which global investors were really expecting and had wagered a lot of money on, just didn't materialize. And that the boogeyman of recession and not being able to tame inflation seems a lot less timid and more manageable right now.
So those were the dogs that didn't bark, I guess. I'm wondering, what about technology? I think we spent quite a bit of time talking about AI and its impacts last year. Was last year, do you think, a turning point in some ways, or is that still to come?
So I think my conclusion after last year is that it wasn't a turning point. My memory of it is that in the first half of last year, we were all frantically talking about Gen AI. It was a huge thing that I think it has erupted slightly before the start of 2023, but we were all obsessed with it at the beginning of last year. I think as the year went on, what's become clear is that while the developments in Gen AI are spectacular and enormously significant, they're also an incremental step in a technology that has been emerging for a while. And we previously talked about big data, or we talked about data science and analytics. And this was the next evolution of those technologies to generate content, but that there hasn't been some deep fundamental breakthrough that's transformed the capability of these things overnight. Instead, they're a very significant technology which is advancing year by year and moving into more and more domains. But certainly for Gen AI, I don't think we've yet seen the transformative use case that actually makes this a technology that's going to immediately transform a whole swath of industries. So that's my take on it now. I would probably have given you a much more excitable take at the start of 2023.
Another dog that might not have barked. Clay, what do you think?
I think it has been really fascinating to watch the AI unfold and people's awareness of it. I mean, in late 2022, we had this technology that kind of magically appeared that seemed completely novel to most of us, at least that we're able to access these kind of things on a consumer basis. And it was rolled out and it was made available to the public. We saw tens of millions, more than 100 million users sign up for this right away. And it was the shiny, bright new object that everyone loved. And I know McKinsey's been talking a lot to clients and companies about the application of AI over the past year. My own sense from talking to CEOs and technology officers is that they're still wrestling with it. They know it's important. They use these very expansive metaphors to describe its impact. When you really get down into the nitty-gritty of, well, okay, how are you using it? Where does it connect your customer? They're a lot more cautious. And I think that's partly because they don't understand it fully yet, but it's also because this stuff is not free. You know, it's expensive to be able to fully roll out. And also because it still has a lot of bugs. You know, anyone that uses it on a regular basis, as I do, knows that it's not very reliable on many, many things. And it's still got a long way to go. And I think that there are also a lot of kind of ripple effects to this technology. It's interesting to me now that you can do searches that are more or less current and up to date on ChatGPT-4 that to think through what the implications of those might be. If suddenly people are using AI to generate a large percentage of what AI is scraping off the web, does this stuff have the potential to just kind of poison itself and by not being original anymore? So I think there are a lot of these interesting questions that we're still just beginning to grapple with. And for firms, the liabilities that go along with that are, I think, really significant.
Yeah, every effort creates its own set of legacies, I suppose. And we've certainly seen that. So if I sum up our look back at the moment, there was always a geopolitical crisis of some sort in 2023. It did not disappoint. So the rebound from global growth was sort of slowed a bit by slightly less than expected China growth. And on the other hand, that inflation maybe came down a bit faster than was otherwise expected, which might be a bit of a tribute to the resiliency of our supply chain. I'm going to ask now, if that's our takeaways from sitting here in Asia, do you think your colleagues in Washington or London would have the same takeaways? Or how much of these takeaways are Asian takeaways and how much of them are global?
Well, as somebody who spent a big part of my career in Washington, I can definitely tell you that the perspective in Asia is totally different than the common paradigm inside the Beltway. That is overwhelmingly evident when it comes to talking about China. China is the one thing that everybody in Washington seems to be able to agree on. And it's just a way more complicated tangle of issues and capabilities than I think a lot of American political leaders understand or perceive. I have been quite impressed by the resiliency of the global supply chain to kind of spread its tendrils around China to work its way into places like Vietnam and to Bangladesh and lately even India with some success. I think that's a trend that's just beginning, but it's very fascinating to see it. And I think the other thing that gets very much ignored in Washington is that supply chains just don't go only east to west anymore. And sitting here in Asia, what we really see is that there is all kinds of traffic now back and forth between rapidly developing markets that just reflects their own wealth. They're buying things from each other, not just making things to sell to rich consumers in the West.
So if I was to capture that, it was to say, okay, well, from the point of view of someone maybe in North America, you might be saying that China is less of an economic issue and more of a political one. And on the other hand, that supply chains are less visible. And so which is very interesting because we sort of do see quite a lot of bemoaning of the state of the U.S. economy by people, but it's the objective reality is inflation is quite down. But what do you think, Robin? Do your colleagues in the rest of the world see things always the same?
So, Laura, I think when I answered before, I tried to give a global answer. I think there's some quite big differences between regional perspectives on some of these things. So Gen AI, for example, it's very interesting how much that is an English language phenomenon or was an English language phenomenon initially. There are significant now Gen AI language models in China, but the corpus of training data available in languages other than English is much, much smaller. And certainly once you get beyond English and Chinese languages to other Asian markets, it's really been quite difficult to come up with Gen AI as impressive as the type of ChatGPT phenomenon that sprung on everybody in English. So I do think there's just generally been less excitement about those technologies across Asia than there has been in the US. So if you're sitting in the US, your perception of that, I think, is quite different. Economically also, and you discussed the US and I agree with everything you both just said, in Europe, 2023 was really a fairly gloomy year economically. I mean, it's been a fairly gloomy period economically in Europe for a while with the war in Ukraine. Just generally, the picture on growth in Europe has been none too happy for the last few years. So I think if you ask European businesses about their domestic economic outlook, it's still a world away from the just general backdrop of growth that you have across most of Asia, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, Bangladesh, China. I mean, China's bad years are 5% years. So it's still just a very different perspective and environment to run a business in.
That is, again, a different outlook. And it sort of goes to the old Chinese saying of where you sit very much determines your perspective. So that's usually said.
You know, the point on technology is quite an interesting one. And I would add to that that it's not just language that gives the potential of these new technologies a different feeling in Asia. It's also the different regulatory cultures. So, for example, if you talk to the big tech platform companies in China, all of them are racing to develop their own generative AI programs, but they're rolling them out in a much more cautious way. They're not just releasing them into the wild in the way that we have done in the United States so that consumers can immediately get their hands on them and experiment with them and try to make them do crazy things and force regulators and creators to somehow then rein them back. In China, these things are being rolled out mostly on an enterprise level because it's much easier to control. So I think that that creates a different level of awareness among the general population in China about what these technologies can do. And it's just a different tempo of development. And I think it's interesting to kind of think about what that means. I would say that probably Japan is a midpoint somewhere in between the US and Europe in terms of how eagerly it's embraced generative AI, and probably Europe is a midpoint somewhere between Japan and China in doing that.
Yeah, makes sense saying that. So yeah, so the broader point being that our technology changes are happening perhaps in a slightly more managed fashion in Asia. But on the other hand, let's talk about what do you think will happen next year. Will we see, you mentioned transformative use cases, Robin, and I'll just start with the technology idea. Will ultimately, we start to see tipping points in industries or sectors as all these CEOs wrestle with this. Is it really optional to not just sort of go for it, start thinking quite expansively about the nature of the workplace and also of the customer interface as well as the supply chain and so forth? What do you see for 24, Robin?
Do you think that we'll start to see transformative uses of AI technologies? But again, I would root it more in a pattern of change that's been going on for a while now, rather than a sudden, oh, Gen AI was invented, and 12 months later, we figured out how to use it, so we're going to completely re-engineer our business around it. I don't think that's going to be how it is. Where I think there is clear potential for transformative change, there are clearly, for example, medical applications when it comes to diagnosis or looking at images with the eyes of a doctor. Instead, it's been trained on millions of prior cases. in law, where, again, there's huge amounts of documents, a lot of it's duplicative work. There may be things that can be automated. But again, I think it's better to look more broadly at the type of AI applications. So one that we were all talking about well before we started talking about Gen AI is autonomous driving, which is simply it's an AI application. It's image-based analysis of huge data corpus of images. And from that, you have the feedback loops that you need in order to provide an autonomous driving solution. As we know, that one hasn't quite come to pass yet, but people are still working very hard on it. I think it's still something that's plausible within a decade. So those are the transformative change things that they are going to happen. And there's the potential for these huge volumes of data, once they're A, analyzed, but then interacting with each other and feeding back on each other, it clearly is going to be transformative. But I also see a little bit of a tendency amongst businesses I talk to where executives have, they've seen the thing that's happening. Oh, it's Gen AI. We need a Gen AI strategy. We've hired 20 people to do Gen AI. And the question now is, well, what's the Gen AI thing we're going to do? And people are trying to come up with a solution that way. And that's not the way that you actually achieve transformative business change. It's far more when you think, here's our problem. This is what the technical solutions now can do to engineer an answer to our problem. And I'm sure at McKinsey, you're talking to people about that all the time.
You'd be fascinated what the conversations are like, I'm sure. But Clay, what are your thoughts on technology before I just sort of throw it open?
I would say definitely that there have been these kind of holy grail-like cases where we have waited for AI to be the magic solution, where it has constantly eluded us and disappointed us. And certainly, autonomous vehicles is the most notable example of that. And I think that people in financial markets are discovering that you can't necessarily program an algorithm to beat the markets either. And that's one that may remain elusive for quite some time. But on the converse of that, I have seen just this year several cases where, borrow an evolutionary term, that are just kind of like punctured equilibrium, where people stumble across what this stuff can do. And it's like, aha. And then it just makes all the difference in the world and they put it into fast forward. I'll give you one example. We do an event, Fortune, that is about business and design. And one of the speakers we had in our design program in December was an architect who's got a very large firm that's got offices throughout Asia, the Middle East, about 1,000 people in his practice. And he said, you know, I've been drawing sketches for giant office buildings. He's done some of the largest projects in Asia. He said, I've been doing this for years. And I've just started a few months ago using this platform called XCool, developed in Shenzhen. It's an algorithm for architects. And he says, let me show you what I can do with it. So we actually brought him real time on stage to demonstrate what he could do just with a few simple sketches, feeding the copy of that sketch done by hand with a marker into a scanner, running it through an algorithm that just sat on a basic laptop. Within 30 seconds, he was cranking out fully rendered drawings of very large, amazing office buildings, ski resorts, all kinds of crazy stuff. He did half a dozen of them in the space of about 5 minutes on stage, and they were all remarkable. And he said, you know, the way we used to work to get these rendered drawings that I could show to a client, it used to take me a week, and I'd have to put four architects on it, and they would have to work around the clock, and we'd go through a model, and then we'd send it out to the renderer, and then we'd come back, and then we could go back and have the discussion with the client. And he said it was torture. But he said, now with this stuff, I'm the torturer because I can generate ideas faster than my clients can demand changes. And he was just ecstatic. And so I think that technology right now is just cutting through architecture, totally transforming the way the whole field works. And anybody that's active as an architect right now is looking at that and going, wow, this business is now going to be very different from what it was last year.
So will this be the year where we see more or fewer architects?
Well, it may not be that we see fewer architects, but it may see that the tempo of being an architect goes way up and that they're able to do a lot more things with the people that they have. And maybe not everybody needs to be a draftsman. Maybe there need to be a lot of people that are just good at figuring out how to use text prompts and visual prompts to get the AI to do what you want it to do. It radically democratizes things. And I think about the irony of all these kids who have been told, oh, if you really want job security in our visually transforming age, you all need to be computer programmers and learn to code. But with AI, you don't necessarily need to know how to code to get cool results using an algorithm. So that turns out to be a lot less kind of a safe career path for somebody that's just emerging out of college right now.
Yeah, very cool. So I'm reminded of Kai-Fu's book, their AI 2049, and his catchphrase about something like, AI makes us all more human because it takes care of all the rest. So it's left us with the human problems. But let me throw it wide open then. So what do you think are the things to watch out for in 2024?
That's very wide open. Obviously, there's some elections. I believe that your fine country is having an election to choose a new president. And I hear that there's two candidates who are controversial among different parts of your country folk. So the rest of the world will be watching the US election, I think, with great interest. But there's a lot more elections around the world. Just in Asia, we've already had Taiwan, but we have Indonesia coming up. We have India as well, which is very significant. There are lots of elections in Europe, including in my country. So that will clearly be something to watch out for in 2024. Economically, I guess we should have the turning of the interest rate cycle. I think it's widely expected that we're going to see US rate cuts at some stage this year, although exactly when and how much is clearly up for debate. Linked to that, I think there's still the impact of previous interest rate tightening to come through on economies. So I think we can still expect to see relative economic slowdown in various places as that takes effect through the rest of the year. And then as ever, there's a host of interesting business things going on in different sectors that we'll certainly be looking out for at the FT.
Clay, what's your top three?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that could definitely go haywire. Yes, we could get the Fed to turn too fast. You never really know with that. There are all kinds of precedents for previous Fed chairmen who have let up on interest rates too early. And so inflation could actually get away from us. That could be a real problem. If you think about the situation in Ukraine, I'm quite concerned that it seems to be slipping below the kind of public radar in the U.S. It doesn't dominate the pages of the newspapers and the websites as it used to. There is a lot of fatigue with American support for Ukraine that's settling in. It does seem to me that there's kind of a stalemate, and possibly we might have either a continued protracted stalemate and that gets out ahead of American willingness and European willingness to supply military aid to Ukraine, or we may have some kind of Russian breakthrough in the front that could then have all kinds of destabilizing implications. I think I worry still a lot about the danger of a protracted slowdown in China. 4.5 is still much better than the rest of the world for the most part, with maybe the exception of India. But still for China, it creates a lot of problems. It'll definitely drag down the rest of global growth, and it will force many big Fortune 500 companies to rethink their global strategies. I think a Trump victory in the election is, Robin, a wild card that can throw sand in the gears of anything, everything. It'll mean doubling down on this America First strategy. It'll mean a new round of tariffs. It'll mean putting trade pressures not only on China, but American allies as well, whether it be India, whether it be Canada, Mexico, even Japan. I think that's the precedent that we know of with Trump, what he will actually push for. I think it means that then the climate accord, again, we go kind of back to square one on that, and we see America exiting from the Paris talks. And I think that could do a lot of damage potentially. And I think that there is, depending on what happens with tax cuts and some of the other fiscal choices, danger of what's already a very precarious fiscal situation in the U.S. kind of spiraling into an even worse place. And that creates all kinds of risks as well. So I think there are many things that can go wrong and that are interrelated in ways that always make forecasting hard.
Especially about the future, the words of Yogi Berra.
Right.
So, but what about the things that might go right? And I think it's always very possible that we tend to overfocus on flashy disaster. But in 2023, I remember the sky is falling on inflation in February. You know, we were going to, I don't know, double digits and 15 and whatever. And then that just didn't happen. I'm not here to interrogate the supply versus demand side of it, but what might be some of the things that might happen, maybe from a positive side, that are not getting quite as much attention as disaster scenarios?
Yeah, I can toss one out just really quickly, and that is, I think the potential for AI to accelerate really dramatic breakthroughs in biotechnology and in the pharma industry, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface on that, and that's going to be really extraordinary. The ability of pharma companies to come up with vaccines in a short space of time during COVID was amazing. But I think it's not impossible to think that that is actually going to become the new normal, because you can use algorithms to narrow the list of candidates, both in the development and the discovery stages, that is just so dramatic that I think it opens up a whole range of new possibilities. So I think that's one where we could really see some remarkable breakthroughs, and I'm sort of cautiously optimistic about that. I'm optimistic also about what's going on in the electric vehicle market, but it will be somewhat destabilizing. I think that market, at least in Asia, certainly in China, is developing far faster than people in the United States recognize. And I think that that has a lot of potential implications, both good and bad, I would say.
Robin?
I agree with everything Clay said. I'm always an optimist about growth in Asia. One thing has consistently been true for a couple of decades now is Asia reliably every year makes a large number of people considerably richer and delivers them a better standard of living. And I think we talked about this in previous editions, but the way that's quietly spread to other places in Asia, I think good examples are places like Indonesia, Vietnam, Bangladesh, India, where now the real benefits of modern economic growth are being widely spread across those populations is something transformational. And it's one of those things that just happens quietly, so you don't see it happening. But the end result is an enormous increase in human well-being. So I think that continues unabated, and that's great. I also think something interesting that's happening is we're starting to see more genuinely innovative business stories coming out of China. So for a long time, China was the manufacturing hub. It was the crucial part of the supply chain. It was where everyone went for growth. But we weren't necessarily seeing Chinese companies emerging onto the global stage. It's a bit of a paradox because the politics is making it much harder for them to do it, just as they are reaching the stage where the Chinese market is generating that kind of thing. So on the consumer side, one of the big stories of 2023 was Temu, the app, which had a global impact. I don't know how long that can continue, but it's an example of the kind of consumer business that's coming out of China. I mean, other sort of globally impactful Chinese companies like DJI, the drone maker, there are many, many more like it that are starting to bubble up and have a global effect. And I do think we're going to see more of those, which is exciting for us to watch as journalists, and I think interesting for consumers around the world. The question is going to be how many of these companies are allowed to make the impact that they would in a free market, because the political restraints and tensions are only getting bigger. And I'm afraid on that, I'm not very optimistic.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I know McKinsey has done a lot of work on this question of leapfrogging. And there's a lot of that really happening, not just in China, but elsewhere in Asia right now, where companies are developing things that are not just minor improvements, more efficient versions of things that were invented elsewhere in the West, but are inventing entirely new business models using technology in completely new ways to organize society, consumers, culture in ways that no one in the West would think of because they have a legacy system. If you think about even something as simple but really profound as trying to bring mobile payments to consumers in a country like Indonesia. I mean, even China, they have banks in all the little villages. People have credit cards, they have bank cards. But in Indonesia, millions of people who've never even seen an ATM machine, let alone been in to open an actual bank account. And in Indonesia, we have these tech platforms who are figuring out how to bring financial services to those people in an extraordinary way, and not just to help them buy things or sell things, but to help them buy insurance, to help them borrow money, to help them with their health and other kinds of issues. And those things are really remarkable. You have companies like TikTok who have created a whole new way of engaging with their audiences and a whole new model for advertising, which, just as Robin says, you know, they're innovative, they're leapfrogging, but they're also potentially vulnerable to these kind of political objections. So I think it's a really extraordinary time. And DJI, definitely, the products that they create are just a whole order of magnitude in terms of their sophistication and relative to what existed before they launched them. So, yeah, it's an interesting time.
So what I hear you guys saying is that if we're looking for big, interesting stories, we should be looking more at the firm level. We should be looking more at the places and people and sort of seeing how, to use your words, Clay, the tempo is accelerating, or companies are bringing things in that create new business models and accelerate the change of an entire industry, maybe partly by simply making it more efficient, but also maybe simply by creating and addressing and unlocking needs that we never knew we had. So to speak of TikTok, I mean, that wasn't really something anybody had on their dance card before it really took off, which is fascinating. But that leads me to push back on that, as you were saying, is that some people don't like change. Some people find change to be threatening. And one of the things that we seem to be agreeing on is that this year will be more of the same in the sense of a lot of controversy about change, and as witnessed through our election cycle, a lot of scrutiny of places that seem to be generating these kinds of dynamic companies. So is that controversy itself? Is that scrutiny itself also a story for 2024? Is it something we should be paying more attention to?
So a couple of thoughts about change. One is that a lot of people in the West just don't realize how much the world has already changed. And that's an Asia thought. But I'm often struck by it when I go back to London. And there are still these certainties which I grew up about, for example, Britain's place in the world, which are just completely untrue these days. It's just so small now relative to places in Asia, which are enormous in terms of their economic and population weight. But people's perceptions and global systems just haven't caught up with that. And I think whenever they're confronted with the reality, this sort of disorientation, what you thought was true turns out not to be true, that people find very hard to deal with. And then a second thought on change is just that our societies are much older than they used to be. And change is hard, or harder, the older you get. So when most of the population of the society was under the age of 20, which is still true in some places and was true in many other places not very long ago, change was exciting, change was an opportunity. But now, for the mass of society, change is something you have to deal with. It's something that upsets the existing order of things, which even if you weren't happy with, you were used to. And I think that's something that underlies a lot of the political and economic tensions that we see in certainly Western societies, but increasingly in advanced Asian societies like Japan these days, that, frankly, it's just a lot of old people, and dealing with change is hard.
I can speak from some personal experience that is true. I just want to come back on that, though, Ron, because I love what you articulated just now about the nature of what we mean by change. Because in actuality, what we're seeing, I think, is an incremental process. It's not like we all woke up one morning and then everything was different. And that was always the case. Nobody blew a trumpet and announced the beginning of the Renaissance. It sort of happened little by little. What does happen stochastically is all of a sudden people wake up in the morning and they have this realization that the world is not how they thought it was, that the mindset shifts. We wrote about this in No Ordinary Disruption years back, basically saying that people wake up in the morning and they all of a sudden realize that, yeah, the place in the world is different. Something has shifted. There's a tipping point. And now we have to, the rules of the game are different. And then you can decide whether you want to try to hold back the waves or not. It's up to you. But you sort of have this moment. And are we going to see some of that this year? I've got one last thing. I'll say one very specific example, Revenge of the Ottoman Empire, sort of the storytelling around how we are now kind of like seeing this, again, this effort to try to channel trade and channel capital into certain ways. And looking back 500 years ago, that didn't work out so well for the Ottomans. So are we going to wake up again in the morning and realize we've had to relearn this lesson, 500 years later about the futility of trying to stop the change, and that we do live in a world where we're going to have to accept it? I don't know. Any thoughts on those? Could this be that year?
Robin and I both work in an industry that has seen more than its share of change. And I remember joking when I was just a cub reporter at the Washington Post and the internet was starting to grind its gears and saying, how strange this is going to seem to my kids or my grandkids explaining what I did for a living. And they're going to say, let's get this straight, Grandpa. You wrote for this thing that they would go out and smash up a bunch of trees, and then they would put them on this big roller, and they would push it out into paper, and then they would have to load it up into trucks and take it one by one to people's houses, and it would sit on your doorstep even if it was rainy and cold and wet, and then you would have to stack it inside your apartment. How silly is that? And if you think about it, it is kind of silly in a way. As much as I love physical newspapers, they are gone. And so in this business, and this is something we write about all the time, and unfortunately, the lesson of modern capitalism is adapt or die. So if you want to stick around, you want to stay on the Fortune 500 list and you're a firm, you've got to figure out how to adjust to that change. And I think with AI, two things are interesting to me. One is that AI now weaves together all these other technologies that have been kind of percolating for the last 10 to 15 years, whether it's big data, whether it's the Internet of Things, all these kind of miniaturization of devices combined with the undersea cables. All these things now kind of work together to create entirely new ecosystems of products, which is, feels to me, it's really new. It's acceleration and change at a faster pace than we've ever had to kind of get used to before. So I think that's kind of a shocking thing in its way. And so to figure out how to be constantly adapting to that, I think is a new challenge.
Robin?
Yeah, so Lola, to go to what you're saying, I think a very natural human psychological response to change and disruption is to seek control, because things are changing around you, triggers your survival instincts, and your response is, well, I want to control my environment. I want to exert some sort of influence over it so I feel that I'm not threatened. And I do think that we see a lot of that now, and I think we'll see more of it in 2024. The trouble, of course, is that that response to seek to control things, which often manifests itself as, well, we want to control it to keep it like how it is, often makes things worse in the long term, because it hampers what Clay was talking about, which was the need to adapt.
Well, I'm phrasing this for myself as a year of restructuring. So that last year is a year of commitment. And so but the commitment is to the change. And I'm given to think about the words homeostasis and allostasis, which I read about recently. And homeostasis meaning the instinctive desire to try to keep things in balance and feeling very uncomfortable when they're not in balance. Allostasis being something more about being comfortable with the idea of changing, of state, keeping one's balance through change, that it's akin to riding a bicycle. And if anybody's tried to balance on a bicycle standing still, it's quite difficult. So, but when one has momentum, then it's largely about keeping everything balanced. And we had to acquire that balance is my metaphor for personal growth this year. But yeah.
It's a good metaphor, but I think business leaders need to be very careful about declaring it a year of restructuring, or they may get some reactions they don't like from their staff.
I wonder about that. I think from their staff, yes. But we have some very interesting research on human capital, which basically says the effect that people keep their jobs for about 2.8 years. So, and that 80% of their departures are going to other companies because they want to get new skills, which is fascinating. So I think we often say one thing and do quite a different thing when it comes to our own personal lives.
That's a quite profound point, I think, and it suggests one challenge for business leaders, which is that, you know, it's very tempting to use a lot of these new technologies, particularly AI, to make things more efficient and cheaper and cost less for the business. But my own view is that the businesses that are really going to succeed are the businesses that think differently about technology, that they think how to make it additive, how to make sure that they're creating a better experience, a better product for customers, and put that first rather than just the kind of thing where they make the cookie that has a little less cream and sell it for the same price. They've got to do something that's a whole new cookie. And so I think that's quite important for business leaders to think about. But I think that there's also, in what you said, there's an inherent challenge for kids, younger people who are just starting their careers or who are in school in the moment where we live. And that is that you have to really prepare yourself with a mindset that says, look, I don't know where the economy, I don't know where technology is going to be 10 years, you know, even as you say, 3 years into my career, it may be in a different, completely different place. And so I have to cultivate this mindset where I have skills, where I not only cope with uncertainty, I embrace it. And I figure out how to make it work. And I just say, okay, change is normal and it's going to get faster and faster. And I have to figure out how to get with the program and capitalize on that. And I think that that's a mindset that, you know, particularly in the US, I think we don't do enough to cultivate that kind of attitude and approach to the time we live in.
Well, I'm happy to hear you say, particularly for the U.S., and then you said we in the sense that we here in Asia. So Asia is, good, my observation, good at change. And so this restructuring, this growth, this acceleration should play to Asia's and all of our, as business people's, advantages. So I think the challenge for the U.S. is how does the U.S. become part of Asia? Well, thank you very much, both of you, for the time. I look forward to the next look back. We might do this more frequently, but we've got a lot to chew on here. And I wish all of you much success, balance, and joy in this year 2024. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Future of Asia podcast by McKinsey & Company. To learn more about McKinsey, our people, our latest thinking, visit us at mckinsey.com/Future of Asia, or find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook.